Jesus replied, "Believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father in this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship." Now check out how he's saying this, okay? Whenever somebody says to you, "You Baldwinsville bees, you don't understand what you're doing. You CNS students, you don't understand. You..." And they begin making you statements. What is that's like somebody pointing their finger at you saying something about who you are. So Jesus in this instance is declaring something about not just her, but about everyone she lives with, the people she comes from, the country she lives in. It's as if he's saying, "You Americans have no clue what you're talking about." Okay? He says, "You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him." This is Jesus talking. "For salvation comes through the Jews. But the time is coming, indeed it's here now, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth." Catch that, it's going to be really important later, all right? Say this with me. In spirit and in truth. All right, that was kind of halfway like you. So the ones in the room who have to go back to school tomorrow, it sounded like you were the ones talking just then. All right, how many of you guys don't have to go back to school tomorrow? Okay, good. That's excitement. I want to hear that tonight. All right. Verse 23, if you're reading along in your Bible, check this out. Verse 23 says, "But when the time is coming, indeed it's here now." Listen to this. "When true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, the Father is looking for those who will worship him that way." What way? What is that way? Thank you, Logan. "In spirit and in truth. For God is spirit, so those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." Amen. Here's what the first thing I want you to get from this is, and that's this. We have talked about Jesus in a couple of different elements. Jesus is a barrier breaker. Do you remember? I don't know if I use those terms, but Jesus in this story, we see him as a barrier breaker. He's not concerned about culture. He's not concerned about her being a woman and him being a man. He's not worried about the social stigma about him talking to her. He's a barrier breaker. Jesus was a man who wasn't afraid to be considered dirty for talking with dirty people. He wasn't a man who was considered to be worried about hanging out with people that the culture said he shouldn't hang out with. He broke through barriers to make sure that the people who needed healing, the people who needed hope, they were the ones that got it. We learned about that a couple weeks ago, and I want to tell you, if you're here tonight and you didn't hear that a couple weeks ago, or it didn't sink in, you need to hear that no matter where you are, and no matter who you are, no matter who has told you that your life is hopeless or useless or invaluable, you need to hear from Jesus Christ that he pushes through the boundaries, those ugly walls that people built up around you, or that you built up around yourself, and he says, your life is valuable. He loves you. He created you for a purpose and a plan. Just like he said to the woman at the well, in this time, he's saying to you tonight, and I'm saying to you right now, that your life is worth something. No matter what people have told you, it's worth something, and Jesus is willing to step into your mess and help you out of it. We learned that a couple weeks ago. We also learned that God is looking for people who are authentic. The fake masks that we put on to pretend to be something we're not are useless before God. But the cool thing is that Jesus doesn't walk into this woman's life and start slapping her around and accusing her of being an adulterous woman, not worthy of his time. He asks her gentle questions and makes clear statements about who she is to the point where she can choose to engage in the conversation or not. He wants authenticity. He wants honesty. He doesn't want to deal with the pretend you. He wants to deal with the real you. How many of you guys want friends and people in your life who are okay with the real you? You want people around you that are okay with who you really are, not who you pretend to be, and you don't want people around you who are pretending to be somebody else. Thank you for raising your hand. You can put them down now. Great. Awesome. You don't want people around you who are pretending to be somebody they're not, right? Because what is it? It's F-A-K-E. Good. You're all spelling at like a third grade level. Awesome. Good. All right. So we learned those two things. We also learned that Jesus, above all things, is focused on a mission. He had a mission in mind. The very first week we talked about this story, we talked about Jesus going from someplace to somewhere. He was going from a city north of Samaria to Jerusalem. He was on a mission. He had a purpose. The purpose that he had was to get to Jerusalem And he was not going to miss that mission for anything. Nothing was going to stop him. Nothing was going to hold him back. He was on a mission. Part of his mission was to meet this woman and to talk to her about worship. Because in this interaction between Jesus and this young lady, she says some things that are very clearly reveal her misunderstanding of what worship is. And if I can be honest, I think we all have the same misunderstandings in the room. I think we all, at some point or another, have had a portion of false worship in our lives. If I can, ask for your full attention, every phone put away, every eye up on me. I love you guys, and I want you to hear this. There is worship in this world that will destroy your life. The first kind of worship we see in this story, and that Jesus calls out for the Samaritans, is selective worship. It's when we walk into a place. Now, hold on. Now, break up the idea in your mind that worship is something that happens on Sunday morning at church. Because I'll tell you right now, worship happens every moment of your life. Whether you think you're worshiping or not, worship, the definition of worship is that you have something in an ultimate place. And it is what you worship. Every one of us has something in a place of ultimate worship that we will move heaven and earth to get to or for. We have it. Every one of us. It's different for everybody. It's the same for a lot of people. But we all have it. And there's this worship that happens that's false. And it's called selective worship. And he calls the Samaritans out for it. And he says this. He says to her, "You don't know the God that you worship, but we do. We Jews do." And what he's saying there is the Samaritans, they only read like 5 books of the Bible. And the Jews had like all of the Old Testament, all of them, all these Old Testament books, and they read through them all. All right? And he's making a statement that they selected parts of God that they liked and worshiped him for those. Can I break this down a little bit and unpack it? How crazy is this? There was a minister who was caring for a man who is, lived a homosexual lifestyle, contracted HIV/AIDS. And he was caring for him. In his later years, he was getting ready to die, and this minister was caring for him and taking care of his medical needs, just wanting to be there for him, to serve him, to care for him. And the minister started getting hate mail and phone calls saying things that I don't even need to get into. You can imagine what some people would say to a minister who's caring for somebody with HIV, who is homosexual. They were saying things like, "He's getting what he deserves. He's being punished for this. He committed a sin, and he's being judged for it." And the minister, of course, handled that stuff, and it bothered him, and it frustrated him. But he came to the understanding that the people who were making those statements were doing something that we see in this story. They were participating in selective worship. They were saying about God, "He is judgment for the sinners." But they were saying it only about the sin that they wanted him to judge. They were selecting a sin that they wanted to talk about God being against. They were creating a component of God that they liked and worshiping that God and ignoring all the rest. And I think if we're honest in the room, we've all experienced somebody who says things about who God is in a pretty ultimate way that, yep, that's what God is. And you know what? If God's like that, he hates them. And we select this part about who God is, and we worship him, and we ignore all the rest. Are you, in a way, tonight, participating in your perception towards God in selective worship? Are you selecting the parts of God that you like and ignoring the rest so you can live the way you want? Or maybe somebody in your life is selecting the parts of God that they like and not, and condemning you for all the parts that he's not. I want you guys to hear clearly that God is bigger than what you could think, know, or understand. He is truth, he is life, he is all-knowing and all-giving. And there's no way any of us could wrap our heads around all of who God is, but Christians are a people who are called to know God more and to be learning to follow him. And as you learn to follow him, you learn to worship him in all of his goodness, not isolating him to one or two of his traits, but allowing the Bible to reveal his whole nature. Not selecting what we like about him and ignoring the rest. All right, so I challenge you tonight. Worship God in all his fullness, not being selective. The other thing we see is that false worship is superstitious worship. You all know somebody who's like, who won't walk underneath a ladder, or like feels a little uncomfortable sitting at a table with 12 people because they know that they're going to be the 13th, right? You ever met anybody who's really weird about numbers? Have you ever met anybody who doesn't like to let a black cat walk in front of them because there might be some bad luck associated with that, right? Well, a lot of people worship God the same way. They say, I better go to church because if I don't, something bad might happen to me. I better worship God because if I don't, something might fall on my head when I walk out of school tomorrow. You know, like we have this tension, this feeling that it's the right thing to do, so I'll do it. And we don't worship God in that sense. We don't worship God out of a desire or out of a love for him. We worship him because we feel like if we don't, we're going to be punished. That's superstitious worship. It's false. It's not true worship from God. It's not how he wants us to be in relationship with him. So are you, as you come here tonight, are you thinking that if you don't do the right thing, God is going to punish you? And you're adding him to a list of different superstitions that you try to compete with and fulfill. And God's just kind of another name on the different list of things that you watch out for. And you try to kind of make him happy so that he doesn't destroy your life. Is that you tonight? If it is, like me, you're involved in false worship. I'll be honest, as I go through these things, I see more and more of my life that fits into some categories. The Samaritans were people who had like 400 gods that they worshipped. And they basically said, okay, if God, if this Lord you're talking about, if he's the God of the land, then we should worship him too. So they added him to a list of gods that they worshipped. And I think if we're honest in our lives as Americans, it's really easy to make up a list of things we worship. My iPhone, my iPod, my iPad, my TV show, my sports, my whatever. And we worship all these things. And I'm not saying any of those things are bad. Hear me on this. I'm not saying any of those things are bad. But when we make them an ultimate thing, and we keep them at the same level as God, we're involving ourselves in a superstitious, false worship of things that will never meet the desire that we have in our hearts, the thing that caused us to chase after him in the first place. Is that you tonight? I know it kind of hit me between the eyes. The third false worship that we see here is an ignorant worship. And I know that word's kind of like, it's tough to hear. Nobody wants to be called ignorant. But I mean ignorant in the way is incomplete or not whole. Ignorant is basically means not having all the information. False worship is ignorant worship. It comes to God partially rather than totally. It comes to God partially rather than totally. Now, here's the thing. Some of us, we've experienced God emotionally. And we've gone to youth convention, and we've gone to events, and we've been in the midst of an environment that's been great music, awesome lights, the environment, the people around you are screaming and shouting, and your heart starts to race, and you feel like, man, I can take on the world. I just want to let go, and I'm going to jump up and down, scream and shout for God. Awesome. This is great. And you go crazy and you run around the War Memorial and you're like doing flips and handstands and stuff and your friends are kicking you and you're doing all kinds of moshing and whatever and head banging for Jesus. And your emotions have you so riled up that you engage in religion that is in part or incomplete. It's not whole. It's ignorant. Okay? And what I mean by that is it can start there. It can start there, but it cannot end there. If it ends there, it will be ignorant and false all your life. Some people, they engage in worship intellectually. And they hear and they confront a truth and they say to a Christian, maybe across a lunch table or at Dunkin' Donuts after school, and they have a debate and they have an understanding where, oh, what I thought was true, I don't think is true anymore. And logically, I can see why this plays out, why this truth is real. And okay, great. If you can prove these other things to me, then I'll believe them. And your journey into faith is completely intellectual and in reasoning. And I want to say that if it stays there, it can start there, but if your faith and worship towards God stays in a simple intellectual reasoning mode, then it's an ignorant worship. Because God has created you to be an emotional being, a thinking being, and a feeling being. He's created you with a soul and a spirit. And all of those together, as they worship God, is true worship, is whole worship, is not ignorant. Okay? And I want to ask you tonight, maybe you're here for the first time, and you're kind of like, man, I don't know what in the world. Do I ignorantly worship something? Am I ignorant? Is he calling me ignorant? Is he saying I'm stupid? I'm not saying that. Okay? I'm not saying that. And what I'm saying is, everything we do is in part separate from the whole. And I want to encourage you and challenge you to bring your whole life together into worship. And say, with everything I am, I submit to this truth. With my mind, with my heart. And believe me, you can't know all the truths. You can't reason everything out. But the Bible calls Christians to have a reason for their faith. It actually says in 1 Peter 3:15 that instead it says, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it. True worship is complete. It comes totally to God rather than partially. So tonight I want to ask you, in your life, whether it's your first time here or not, have you committed your life completely and wholly to something? Have you taken your life and said, I want to surrender to that? I want to give it all to that. And if you consider yourself a Christian in the room, yeah, the answer there should be, I have surrendered my life to God. I've given it to Him. But I think if we're honest, even if you call yourself a Christ follower, you could say that there's part of your life that has been given to something else. And what you've done is created an incomplete worship, a superstitious worship that says, God, you can have this much of my life, and there's this part that I kind of love this. Don't mess with this. God says, Jesus says, true worship is complete, and it comes totally to God rather than partially. In the verses, in verse 21, I want to read this to you guys. It says, Jesus replied, believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father at this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him. For salvation comes through the Jews. Now check this out. How many of you guys, when Easter comes around, don't raise your hands, but you think, I'm going to go to church and worship because that's what you do on Easter. Don't raise your hands. You don't have to. But I think it's easy for us to perceive that worship happens in a certain place. And for as long as Christianity has existed, this idea has been attempted to be unpacked and disconnected from what worship truly is. Because worship, Jesus says here, worship is not dependent on a place where you are. You can worship God in your bathroom, in your kitchen, in your basement, in your bedroom. You can worship God at school. You can worship Him right here. It's not about where you are. It's about who your life is surrendered to and all things you do. Worship isn't about things. It's not about places. It's not even about gifts. It's not about things. If God said, I am a thing, worship me in things and truth, then it would make sense to come in here and every time we worship to have like an animal sacrifice where we cut the animal in half and lay it up here and burn it. That would make sense. But He doesn't say that. He says, God is spirit and in truth. God is spirit and truth, and we worship Him in spirit and in truth. That means that the things that we think are related to worship aren't important. They hold importance to us. But to God, you know what's really important about our worship? The spiritual things. The things that you can't hold in your hand. The spiritual things like your love for one another. Kindness, mercy, grace, forgiveness. The things that are part of who you are that can't be handled. The spiritual things. Sometimes we call them the fruit of the Spirit. These things that are that flow from us, not because we build them, but because they're part of our DNA. And when we say, God, have me, we're saying, God, have the parts of me that cannot be changed. Have my spirit. Have it all. In spirit and in truth. It's not about things, it's not about places, it's not about gifts. The woman said, in all this, he's kind of talking to her, and he's unpacking this stuff, kind of like I'm trying to do tonight. And I know that her response is similar to some of yours tonight, where you're just kind of like, yeah, whatever. You know, this is, I've kind of heard this before, and I'm trying to figure it out, but at some point along the way, I'll have to stop and think it through really. And when that happens, I know there's somebody coming that will explain all this to me. And she says this to Jesus, like you would say to me tonight. Like you in your chair would get up and say to me, you know, at some point I'm going to think about this and really try to understand it. But tonight, I just got a lot going on. I'm thinking about what's happening later tonight and what's happening tomorrow. And The Walking Dead's coming up, and I want to think about that. And you kind of postpone the decision to investigate worship and faith, just like she did with Jesus. And Jesus says this astonishing thing back to her when she says, I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. She's saying to him, yeah, I know. At some point I'll have to think about this, and there will be somebody who will tell me about it, but not yet. I don't really want to think about it yet. And maybe some of you are doing that right now. Maybe at times while I've been talking, you've thought, there are things in my life that I worship, and I could care less about what he says because I like it. And someday I'll have to deal with that, but not tonight. That's what she said to him at the well. And the biggest difference between then and now isn't the question and the statement she's making. It's the answer he gives her. Because we're all asking the same question. We're all making the same statement she's making, like, whatever. But the difference here is that Jesus says something insanely, insanely significant. He tells her, I am the Messiah. I am the Messiah. I am the one you're saying that at some point you'll have to talk to get the explanation from. I am that one. Now, I'm not saying I am that one tonight. I am not the one. Jeremiah is not the one that you need to get your answer from tonight. Jesus is the one. He is the Messiah. Not long after this portion of Scripture is happening here in the story, there's another moment in Jesus' life where he is declaring that he is the Messiah. And in just a few days, we are going to see Christians and believers and unbelievers all over our country, all over the world, come together in a place and in places to remember Jesus being the Messiah. And some of the people that go to those places called churches will be honestly worshiping, will be worshiping completely. I want to ask you, do you know why we worship honestly and completely? Do you know what it is that causes people to worship honestly and completely? Not out of a sense of need or a fear of being punished for not doing it, but because you belong to someone? What could make it so important to somebody that they lay their entire lives down before God and say, take it, have it? It's a good answer, but it's an incomplete answer. I'm glad you asked, Rebecca. Here it is. In Psalm 22, when Jesus was hanging on the cross, he said this. And some of you who've been in church for a while, you'll recognize this. Jesus went to the cross and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? When Jesus says that, in our culture, if you're unschooled, if you're ignorant to the rest of God's word, if you're ignorant to where he's quoting from, you don't know what's happening here. Guys, hear this. Jesus isn't just saying one or two lines that are significant. He's quoting from an Old Testament chapter, an entire chapter that Jews would have to memorize early in their life. And he's saying way more than, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's saying way more than I love you. He's saying way more. What he's saying is, though these people are filthy and full of sin, and they belong to be pushed away from you, God, they belong and they deserve to be dead, you're abandoning me, the Messiah. And Jesus hung on the cross and looked down at humanity and said, my God, why are you forsaking me? Why have you abandoned me here? And if you don't know the rest of that chapter, it kind of loses some meaning, because he was communicating to the people at the base of the cross, his mom, his closest friends, the people who knew this chapter and knew what it meant for him to be saying it. They didn't know before, if they didn't know before, they knew now what it meant to them that he was hanging on that cross. I want to read you that chapter. Listen to this. This is a chapter in Psalms. It was written hundreds of years before Jesus was even born or even thought of. It says this. This is the quote that Jesus is making when he's hanging on the cross. My God, why have you abandoned me? Why are you so far away when I groan for help? Now that's where he stops on the cross. But everybody around him knows that the rest of the chapter reads like this. Every day I call to you, my God, but you do not answer. Every night you hear my voice, but I find no relief. Yet you are holy. Enthroned on the praises of Israel, our ancestors trusted in you, and you rescued them. They cried out to you, and they were saved. They trusted in you, and were never disgraced. But I am a worm and not a man. I am scorned and despised by all. Everyone who sees me mocks me. They sneer and shake their heads, saying, is this the one who relies on the Lord? Then let the Lord save him. If the Lord loves him so much, let the Lord rescue him. Yet you brought me safely from my mother's womb, and let me trust it in you at my mother's breast. I was thrust into your arms at my birth. You have been my God from the moment I was born. Do not stay far from me, for trouble is near, and no one else can help me. My enemies surround me like a herd of bulls. Like lions, they open their jaws against me, roaring and tearing into their prey. My life is poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax melting within me. My strength is dried up like sun-baked clay. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You have laid me in the dust and left me for dead. My enemies surround me like a pack of dogs. An evil gang closes in on me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count my bones. My enemies stare at me and gloat. I'm going to stop there for a second, because you need to know that was written. If you know the story about Jesus Christ, his hands were nailed to a cross. His clothes were torn from him and gambled over. People circled around him, soldiers, sneering at him, calling him names, ripping the beard out of his face, shoving a crown of thorns on his head. Isn't it a compelling comparison to this chapter in Psalms written hundreds of years before he was even thought of? And he quotes it like he wrote it. And the people around him knew that this man wasn't just a man hanging on a cross, but it was the man the Psalms talked about. It was the man that the Old Testament spoke of when it spoke of a redeemer and a restorer. They divide my garments among themselves and throw dice for my clothing. Lord, do not stay far away. You are my strength. Come quickly to my aid. Save me from the sword. Spare my precious life from these dogs. Snatch them from the lion's jaws and from the horns of these wild oxen. Goes on to say, praise the Lord, all you who fear him. Honor him, all you descendants of Jacob. Listen, Jesus' life was in the balance, and he was saying, God, save me. God, rescue me. And he wasn't saved, and he wasn't rescued. He wasn't saved, and he wasn't rescued, because if he had been saved and rescued, you would not be. Your sin, the things you worship that are not God, they separate you from him. And the only way that you or I could come back into a relationship with God is to have those things covered by the death of Jesus Christ. Because he was perfect, and died our death, we can be imperfect and live his life. So I want to ask you, as I close my computer, I want to ask you to respond to this word tonight. I'm going to pray in a moment, but I told you at the beginning of the night that we were going to worship a different way. We're going to worship a different way tonight, and the way we're going to worship is by an act of surrender.